Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 12th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag Programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold is at AgriGold.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is a special holiday edition of the Closing Market Report. In a few moments, we'll look into the crystal ball for what's ahead for commodity futures in 2015 with Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics in Atchison, Kansas. Also this half hour, we'll take up the issue of rail transportation of grains with Randall Gordon, president of the National Grain and Feed Association in Washington, D.C. And it's our pleasure to reach into the archives for a Tis the Season edition of Backyard Industry. It's all on this holiday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Illinois farmers by offering financial products and services geared specifically to the farm community and developing partnership-based relationships with its agricultural customers.
Joining us on the telephone for this special holiday edition of the Closing Market Report is Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics, and he is in Atchison, Kansas. Good afternoon, Mike.
Nice to be with you, Dave, and happy holiday to you and everybody listening.
Thank you, and right back at you. Let's begin our conversation by looking at 2014 and ask you, as we look back on this year, what will be the distinguishing features looking at the futures market?
You know, I think, Dave, when it comes to the 2014 marketing year, I think the biggest factor is that we have developed more as a 2009 market and more as a 2013 market than many had expected back in August and September. And so I think that trend continues to this day when we see futures markets rallying and cash basis rallying. And I think if USDA gives us a decent, meaning not burdensome, supply reports on both December and January, that would be the same type of model that I'd be using as a marketer, as a medium-term hedger, as I go into the first of the year for the remaining crop sales that have to be sold in the cash market.
We are talking to Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics. And as we look ahead in broad strokes, what are you looking for the 2015 futures market?
You know, I think the biggest feature that I can see as a pretty high likelihood is that while the supply side of the equation will remain important as we determine the Northern Hemisphere acreage balance of wheat, corn, and soybeans, after we get those springtime planted acres kind of put to bed, and obviously we have the natural Mother Nature question mark of how quickly we get the corn and beans and wheat in the ground, and whether we have winter kill in the late spring, in early spring, late winter time period, I should say. I think other than those things, 2015 is probably shaping more as a demand push market as it is a supply pull market. And what I mean by that is I think the macro environment and the currencies will take a lot more precedent. Investor money and export demand will be more closely associated, I think, with demand than it will be with supply. And I think it'll be a lot like the mid to late 1990s when it comes to the overall commodity setup and the futures markets for commodities.
We are talking to Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
We are talking with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Atchison, Kansas. At the end of 2014, the last quarter of 2014, there was a lot of economic news that showed from a world level, several countries are having difficulty. Japan is one. Russia certainly is another one. The Asian Rim, China, is also having difficulty economically. And as a result, they've been doing a lot with their currencies to try to stem the tide. Does that continue in the 2015? And if so, what are the implications for the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, I think it does continue into 2015, Dave. There is an uncanny economic environment similar to right now as what we had in the late 1990s. As you said, what the current issues are, the back in the 1997-1998 time period, Japan was in deflation. You had a positive oil supply shock that took crude oil futures sharply lower. That brought with it a United States economy that was called a Goldilocks economy, where you had higher GDP and output, but you had almost deflationary pressure. You also had that stronger dollar that you're talking about back in that time period. You also had a Russian currency crisis back in that time period. And not to lop too much onto it, but I also found it very amazing that politically Bill Clinton suffered in the midterm 1994 election a real hit in the Congress. And so it is an uncanny environment that we walk into 2015 in terms of the similarities to the 1997 through 1999 time period. And what essentially happened was the U.S. economy was strong for a couple years. It kept inflation at bay here domestically. But by 1999 and 1998, with the Russian currency crisis, we then had the 1999 Asian financial crisis, which then helped the United States go back into recession in 2000. All these factors kept the dollar very, very strong. It didn't go straight up all four of those years, but it held most of its gains that it had made in the 2.5 year time period that it did rally.
So would you anticipate U.S. inflationary pressure to increase next year?
I don't think so. I think what you're probably going to see is, unless you have a sharp turnaround in gold prices or crude oil prices that would push the dollar back down, I think what you'll see is lower real import prices, lower real energy prices, and if you see those two things, you're probably going to have lower inflationary pressure as well. And one thing that is a question mark is back in the late 1990s, you did have slower inflation building in medical costs, and that was an additional feature to the Goldilocks economy back then. You don't have that here as much going into 2015, but I think that's a minor issue when it comes to the inflationary pressure.
Let's talk a little bit more about oil prices. We had news recently from Kuwait that their people believe that oil prices will remain mired around the $65 level for the first 6 months of 2015. We've had an increase in U.S. oil production, primarily due to fracking. We've noted that the spreads between ethanol and the RBOB are closing in on one another. What do you look for next year?
Above $80 a barrel, West Texas Intermediate in the first 3 months of 2015 is the top end that I can see in this crude oil market going forward. And I say that not just because of what you bring out astutely with the Kuwaitis, but also the numbers really project right now, and I'm not sure I believe this, but I think the going rate that the world is thinking that the Saudi Arabians can produce a barrel of oil at is still around $5 to $6 a barrel. Even if it's $10 a barrel, which I think it's probably closer to, I think it really begs the question and answers the question as well that they're in it for the long haul in terms of trying to break the back of the shale production here in the United States and retake being the major cartel oil supplier in the world. And so they will go, I think, in the next 3 to 5 months, as long as they need to at lower prices, maybe even sharply lower prices at times, to be able to regain that supply, because they really are in it for the long term at this point. I think, corresponding with that, that's kind of the supply side of the equation when it comes to your answer, Dave. I think the demand side is we saw China and its GDP in 2014, especially the last half of 2014, miss on its growth estimate for the first time since 1999. So demand is also, and consumption is also, starting to falter at the same time that OPEC and Saudi Arabia are working very hard to take prices lower, and the dollar's going higher as a result of that. So everything is working in favor of keeping the supply up, keeping the price down, and I see that going for at least the first quarter of 2015.
What does this mean then as we continue this discussion of ethanol and oil for corn grind next year?
Well, it's a good thing initially because you can break the barrier of the government amount of subsidy, the RFS. You can break through that ceiling because you can pump more gas at E10 levels than the mandated specified amount. But like in 1997, 1998, and 1999, you can have too much of a good thing. And this is where your investor sentiment comes back. This is where your actual export demand comes back. The ethanol can only pull the cart so hard. If your exports start to falter because of a strong dollar and a currency problem in Asia and in Russia, and you see demand start to falter, and then you see the investors start to think that deflation is more of a pressure, then you probably have those things offsetting what good ethanol can do. So I go back to the 97, 98, 99 model for corn specifically because the Japanese yen is such a large proportion of corn prices in terms of the correlation. But in 97, 98, 99, we saw at least a 20% decline in corn prices. The December futures, all three of those years, declined about 20% or a little over 20% between March and July. We made a hard low in July, either went sideways or tried to regain some of the premium as the contracts expired. And that's essentially the template that I'm going to be using in 2015 for sales, that we want to be very busy at 4.25 and above December 15 corn, getting hedges in place in anticipation of the dollar shooting higher. If the dollar doesn't shoot higher, there's plenty of ways you can re-own corn or lift out of hedges if you break through some key areas in the December futures.
Will oil blenders use their RINs in the first half of next year?
I don't know if they will or not. I mean, it depends on the consumption side of the equation. If the demand is not that low, or excuse me, the demand is not that high, then the RIN demand is probably going to remain low, and they'll actually blend. And you know, their profitability is still around 70 cents a gallon based upon the numbers I use. And so at this price level, they'll want to actually blend, I think, unless the consumption starts to shoot sharply higher, because you don't want to give up that kind of profitability and save those RINs for a rainy day, so to speak.
Let's turn our attention to treasuries and bonds. How does that play out next year?
Well, I think this is the hardest part of the analysis because you did not see sharply higher interest rates, because you did not see sharply higher inflation, if that model of the late 90s is to be used. However, Dave, if you have a sharp drop in the equities markets and you have a sharp drop in the currency markets and you have essentially an Asian financial crisis all over again, it would make sense to me that the VIX, the volatility index, would rally sharply, and that could actually push the benchmark, the U.S. Treasuries, that are the benchmark yields for the United States Department of Treasury, the 10s and even the 30s, which are no longer the benchmarks, but those benchmarks and those longer-dated treasury yields would probably go up in a safe haven-type buying mindset, at least in the short term, meaning maybe 2, 3, 4 months. But if you have deflation and you have a strong dollar, you tend to not really see a lot of higher yields. You actually see the bonds more purchased, and that keeps yields dragged down or pulled down a bit.
There's been some signals in speeches from Fed officials that perhaps the Fed will not raise its short-term interest rates until maybe the third quarter of next year. Do you think that's likely?
I don't think they're going to raise rates. I have a very hard time believing that, given the European Union, given the borrowing costs that Russia is facing, given the fact that Russia is missing a lot of their economic data or economic strength from the sanctions that have been placed on them, and China is starting to feel the effects of both Europe and Russia, and now also Japan. And what you brought up earlier, this essentially currency war or race to the bottom to get as many exports as possible from your neighbor. It's the typical beggar thy neighbor type policy of a race to the bottom to secure what market share you can when it comes to exports. And I think the Fed's very well aware of this. And this is where the Fed's a little bit trapped, because they see U.S. inflation going higher because of the strong economy, but they see the world seeing deflationary pressure. Here again, that's where the crude oil prices come in and the dollar comes in. If the dollar stays strong and crude oil stays down, the Fed really isn't forced to move because they don't feel the inflationary pressure. You essentially go back to that Goldilocks-type economy that we had in 97, 98.
With $4 corn, are we going to have an old-fashioned acreage battle between corn and soybeans in the spring based on the idea of corn production costs?
Yes, I think that is in the offing right now, and I think this is where producers probably would be well advised at this stage of the game, Dave, to watch the January and February bean corn ratio, because the higher the beans go in relation to the December corn, the more likely you're going to garner more bean acres because of those cost of production and even your break-even levels. Both Purdue and University of Illinois would say on good average or even good, better than average soils, not only is your cost of production lower, but your profitability is higher if you're using 350 corn and 910 beans. And so the higher beans go, say on a South American weather market in January, February, while that base price for crop insurance is being made, the higher the beans go in relation to the December corn, I think we need to be ready to see bigger bean acres at the expense of corn, and you have to adjust your marketing plan accordingly. And that goes back to the corn hedging model of the late 1990s. If I see corn acreage fall below 89 million, I don't have to be as nervous about the downside potential. Doesn't mean the upside's going to be sharply higher, but I don't have to be as nervous about the downside potential in the December 15 futures. The exact opposite would be the case when it comes to the November bean futures. The higher those acres go because of the ratio in January, February, I think the more aggressive you need to be on both cash and paper positions to lock that $10 profitable level in, $10 plus, when it comes to the cash price.
Is there anything else our listeners need to know about regarding 2015 futures?
You know, I think the other thing that is maybe a contrast to 2014, and this is kind of the basis of the grain analysis, is wheat was a very negative force in the market in most of 2014 until we got to September. So essentially, for 9 months of the calendar year, wheat was a negative force in the market. I think you have the exact opposite situation brewing in 2015, especially if you begin to see an El Nino take shape in the southern hemisphere, so that you see Brazil, Argentina, India, and Australia suffer with lower production potential, and that puts more upward pressure on wheat to get planted in the northern hemisphere. So I see 2015 wheat as an underpinning or supportive feature to the corn market, not a negative feature. Here again, that would be one of those different elements that we had, that we have now versus what we had in the late 1990s.
Thanks, Mike.
Dave, thank you so much, and happy holidays.
Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Atchison, Kansas.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 12th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold is at AgriGold.com.
For a second year in a row, grain farmers in the Western Corn Belt, especially Minnesota and the Dakotas, have been hurt by a lack of available rail service to ship grains to market. Part of the issue revolves around an increase in oil and gas rail shipments, bumper crops in 2013 and 14, and a finite number of cars and locomotives. The issue has become so severe that earlier this year, Congress directed the Surface Transportation Board to provide weekly updates on how commodities are being transported. Grain elevators say they are losing money, and part of those losses are passed on to individual farmers. I spoke with Randall Gordon, president of the National Grain and Feed Association, to get a progress report.
The rail issue did not happen overnight. It is an issue that was some time in the making. I suspect it even went back to 2013. So let's look at the backstory first from your perspective.
Well, you're right, Dave. It really started well into certainly the early summer of last year. And it began to build in 2013. You're absolutely right. But I think what we saw happen at that late summer time frame was a tremendous ramp up of volume for the railroads from the coal sector, which wasn't anticipated given their situation, and more exports of coal from the oil industry, of course, with the crude oil and the Bakken crude issues. We saw a good economy starting to improve again, so intermodal shipments were up quite a bit. And then we had a big crop that came on fast at the same time. So the rail service issues really began to become very severe in the fall of last year, well before the onset of the winter weather, and that just exacerbated the problems and caused further recovery delays in the system. I think this year the situation is better in the west. It's not very good in the east yet. I think CSX is beginning to get to a more normal state, but the Norfolk Southern, what I'm hearing from our members, is in a real bad situation right now of shortage of crews, shortage of locomotive power to pull trains. Trains are sitting idle even after they're loaded for several days. The turn times of moving the cars are very slow.
The trains now have to report to the Surface Transportation Board weekly reports. As you look at those reports and read them and read between the lines, there's almost an apologetic tone about it. But I don't, when I look at those reports, don't see solid long-term solutions there.
Yeah, I think that's right. We did encourage the STB to expand the reporting requirements on the railroads, simply so we could have a better snapshot of what the actual performance was. And so some of those data points are helpful for the near term, so we can, elevators and others can predict, have more predictability on what the service performance is going to be. That was one of our big problems last year, too, is there was such a lack of transparency in some cases, where shippers couldn't plan on what their merchandising situation ought to be, how much grain should they be buying based on what they could get shipped. So the increased reporting is helpful near term from that perspective. And frankly, I think it does keep the focus on the issue for the Surface Transportation Board of seeing how fast, if at all, the recovery is beginning to occur. But you're right. Longer term, I think we're in discussions with each of the major Class 1 railroads on their investment in crews and power, locomotive power, as well as track capacity. It's going to be a long-term situation. And even the BNSF, which is investing, you know, billions of dollars in their rail network right now in the Northern Plains, and their shuttle movements going west to the Pacific Northwest are much more fluid now than they were a year ago. It's going to be a 2 or 3 year process as these carriers invest in their system to where we think the new normal is in terms of rail demand going forward. It's a tricky business. You know, railroads are a business too, and they project based on the demand they think they're going to have, and some have been faster to pick up the new normal, in our view, than some other carriers have been. And the NS has been lagging in that regard.
Randall Gordon is president of the Grain and Feed Association in Washington, D.C. It's National Champagne Day. Also, Happy New Year's Eve. On this day in agricultural history in 1600, the British East India Company was incorporated by royal charter. It was created to compete in the East Indian spice trade. In 1833, Obed Hussey of Maryland was issued a patent for a reaper. It was drawn by horses hitched in front and had a side cut and a platform on which the operator stood who raked off the grain. In 1846, James Cochran died, an American inventor. He created a process to manufacture cut nails. In 1879, Thomas Edison made the first public demonstration of his electric light bulb. Edison's lamp was the first to be practical because he had solved the problem of short-lived filaments. After testing many materials, he found suitable a carbonized filament. He also created a good vacuum in the globe to remove oxygen. In 1917, sugar rationing began in Britain as a result of World War I. And in 1929, Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians played Auld Lang Syne as their New Year's Eve song for the very first time. And that's This Day in Agricultural History. Up next, Lisa Brotz hits the kitchen for some do-it-yourself magic in this vintage edition of Backyard Industry.
I happen to be overly tuned in to seasonal weather anyway, so to me, snow appearing right as the holiday season is ramping up is a good thing. Whatever wasn't cleaned up in the garden, which was almost everything, is now covered in several inches of snow and looks pretty. This includes the rainbow chard, which was the last edible green thing I had going back there. Local food from the backyard or from someone else who grows it is not as bounteous in our area this time of year, at least not in the showy way produce is during the traditional growing season. But it's still there, quietly provisional, not making a big, obvious deal about itself. We're lucky enough around these parts to have producers still offering locally grown root vegetables and locally raised meats, cheeses, and eggs through a variety of outlets, so this means your holiday meals can have a major local component. Not so much the holiday baking, though. The major ingredients that go into our beloved cookies, cakes, and other sweets, the flours, the sugars, the dried fruits, the chocolate, don't grow here, or if they do, they're not easy to find or they're not available in the massive quantities we need to feed our holiday appetites. But this is okay. Even though we can't necessarily provide locally sourced sweet things for the holidays, we can certainly provide them locally made. Over the weekend, I visited with my neighbors Kate and Ben, who were whipping up a bunch of amazing food for their friends and business patrons. Ben mused a little bit on what handmade means to his family at the holidays while dipping coconut bars into melted chocolate.
It's hard to get coconut, almonds, chocolate produced right around here. But I think doing things by hand rather than just buying a bag goes a long way anyhow. Not only the sort of do-it-yourself aspect, but doing it together as a family aspect is nice, and knowing that you put some time into to making something worthwhile is something I think that the holiday season is kind of all about.
So, handmade holiday food is part of tradition and part of giving. And in many circles, my own family included, it's a part of holiday expectations. A traditional handmade food can make an event, can make an evening, can even make a holiday. It's also something you can make with someone else, and you don't necessarily have to be super accomplished in the kitchen to be successful. Our family's major, major winter holiday favorite isn't a cookie. It's cinnamon rolls from scratch. We all love them and wait for them every December in the same way we wait for asparagus and strawberries in the spring and peaches, corn, and tomatoes in the summer. I love making these with my daughter, Lily. I don't remember helping out much in the kitchen as a young person, but Lily's been at my elbow for years, and now, at 12, she's able to make them herself, from making the dough to shaping. This is a great thing for many reasons, not the least of which is because I commit to making many, many batches of these for friends and family every year, and I can use the help. Here's why I do it. You see, these cinnamon rolls were Christmas morning food in my childhood home. It dawned on me in adulthood that my mother made these rolls ahead of time and froze them not just because she loved us, but also so she could pop them in a slow oven for 45 minutes at the crack of dawn when my brother and I woke up, and could then relax and enjoy the morning with her family rather than be in the kitchen making a bunch of food while it was still dark outside. By gifting these rolls, I'm not just bringing the gift of awesome food to my friends and family, I'm also buying them a couple of hours of freedom on a groggy holiday morning. Perhaps you'll consider doing the same.
Can I eat one?
You will be able to eat one.
Happy holidays, everyone.
And that is today's holiday edition of the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey.